This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to the Bible Show. That's gonna take a while to get used to. Joining me today, I'm your host, Sam. Joining me today is Will.
Hi, Sam.
And this is going to be a little bit of a special episode. Like, we didn't plan on doing this. We were planning on walking and just continuing right into Exodus, as we will be doing. But something really interesting happened over the weekend that I kind of wanted to stop and talk about, because it actually has some pertinence and relevance to what we've been talking about for the last several weeks, which is the Ten Commandments. So if you've heard, I mean, it was on social media and Twitter, probably you haven't heard this because most of you have lives, but Richard Dawkins, who is probably the most famous atheist and kind of the evangelistic atheist, he's in 2006, he wrote The God Delusion and has actively campaigned to basically do away with Christianity and to really challenge and mock the Christian God and to mock Christians for believing in that God. And he has been very caustic and condescending. When I was a brand new believer, I came to faith at the end of 2002. And so in 4 years, you know, I had some weak legs underneath my faith. You know, I was really believing it, diving into Christianity. And in 2006, Richard Dawkins wrote The God Delusion. And it started what was called this new atheism movement, where you had guys like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and a whole bunch of people that were getting all kinds of publicity all over the world, all through Western culture, basically saying that it's absurd to believe in Christianity anymore. Beyond just like the old arguments that Bertrand Russell used to make, you know, they really were anti-theist. You know, it wasn't just, you know, it's not, we don't believe in God, that's not rational, and there's no objective science, and blah, 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 blah. It became, religion is evil. Religion is terrible. We need to get rid of religion. And this weekend, he said something that we're going to talk about later in the podcast that was really kind of shocking. If you heard 2006, 2007, Richard Dawkins, and you showed a clip of Richard Dawkins from this weekend, it would be a startling contrast, Will.
Yeah, it's kind of wild when you brought up Richard Dawkins, like, because in 2006, I was in the sixth grade, so not much thought going on there about the bigger things of life. But I've only known him as the guy who really hates God. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know much about him. I even had to ask you, like, other than that, what is he famous for? And you had to tell me he's a biologist of some kind. So I think for a lot of people also, there's just a murmur that we kind of know what Richard Dawkins is about, but all we really know is that anti-God for sure.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I became such a fan of like apologetics and being able to defend your faith and going and looking at archaeology and understanding philosophy and understanding the major arguments is because these guys came along, and anytime you ever talked about God, the objections were always the same, and they were the objections that were lifted up by these guys. And they were the objections of, you know, textual criticism and can you trust the Bible, and, you know, all of the, you know, the litany of arguments is always the same. And so you had to become very familiar with these guys if you were an evangelist, because their arguments had permeated all of this, the youth culture. And so it really did have an impact on the church. And of course, you know, the church doesn't have fierce lions or many of them that really defend the truth. And so since 2006, the church has really, I think, been weakened and has not stood firmly for the truth. I mean, of course, there's exceptions to that. The minority of the church is evangelical, strong. They affirm the word of God. They would uphold the Ten Commandments without apology. But this movement really made a lot of novice Christians or immature Christians really shaky in their ability to say, no, I do believe this.
And the way these guys became a popularized name in culture, even in a sense, with podcasts and books and things like that, kind of took over in a sense.
Yeah, very much. And it became like you felt stupid because they didn't come and say, hey, I have a rational argument I would like to discuss with you. I mean, they were throwing bombs. They were kind of incendiary language. Like, if you believe this, you're not worth talking to. Mm. And there was a lot of young people that would see clips of these guys or read excerpts from the book without a solid person to defend them and say, hold on a minute. this is how you address this from a Christian perspective. You know, let's fight them on their own turf and show the stupidity, frankly, of their own beliefs and where their beliefs lead. And the really zealous Christians that were solid in the faith, that were honoring to God in that moment, were really warning, like, where this goes is really dangerous, because if their ideology, if their worldview wins, a worldview that's penned upon atheism is a really dangerous, dangerous, dangerous place to go. And of course, they would dismiss that and say, what do you mean we have no basis for our morality? Because that's the argument of the Christian. Hey, if there's no higher truth, if there's no absolute truth, which is kind of gets back to where we talked about with the first commandment, that there's one God and he reigns with authority over everything and his truth is the truth, period, end of story. If you abolish that, then you have this myriad range of truth, and who gets to determine truth? Well, it's whoever has the
power.
And so you've got these guys that at the beginning was like, oh, that's not true. How dare you say that I don't have a system of morality? Well, now, you know, less than two decades after this movement start, all these new atheists and the people that jumped up and down celebrating the hostility toward religion, guys like Bill Maher, are looking at the world that this new atheism has created, and they're going, whoa, I don't like this at all. This is no good. This is, our liberties are being endangered. And you can add Richard Dawkins to that list. And so what I wanted to do today, what we talked about doing today, was to sit down coming out of a series on the Ten Commandments where we explain, man, the Ten Commandments, they're the fabric and design of God's creation. They're interwoven into the way the world works. They lead to life and beauty and flourishing when we follow them. But on the other hand, an abandonment of God and God's design and his laws leads to death and despair and destruction and the loss of liberty. And what I want to show, like, the new atheists are learning that. They're figuring that out now. And it seems like more and more this message is front and center, because a couple of weeks ago, the world's biggest podcast, which is the Joe Rogan Experience. How many listeners does he have? Do you remember offhand?
It's like 14 million an episode.
14 million people listening per episode. And it's far and away. There's not even like a close second to that. Like, he is far and away the biggest podcast. He's bigger than CNN, bigger than Fox News, bigger than all the different outlets in terms of people that are listening to him. So, well, anyway... And he's not a believer, you know, he gives no indication that he's a believer. But anyway, in an episode maybe a couple of weeks ago, they waded into this exact topic. He was interviewing Aaron Rodgers, who's a NFL quarterback, and they both started talking about the deterioration of society that has come now that religion is increasingly dismissed, ignored, it's viewed as bad, because we now live in a world that anything ancient is evil, right? Because we've thrown out the fifth commandment. So everything that's ancient, whether it's religion, the Bible, Constitution, the founders, they're all bad. So we've gotten rid of all of them. And so you have Rogan, who's not a confessing Christian, but he seems to recognize that the world is becoming increasingly insane, unsafe, divisive, because we've abandoned our belief in God. So I want to, right now, let's listen to a clip of Joe Rogan and Aaron Rodgers talking about that on his program.
But don't you think there has to be some sort of field of value that can orient people into, like, hey, let's do things a little bit better because these things actually matter. There is right and wrong. There is morality. Yeah. There is certain, like...
Well, unfortunately... The problem with Rogan living in a secular society and living in a society that has a lot of people that are atheists, that have no belief system at all, is you find a belief system. And that's a lot of these people that call themselves atheists, or they've subscribed to the religion of woke. You know, their God is equity and inclusiveness. Their God is this ideology that they think that you have to subscribe to. And that's why it's spooky, because people, human beings seem to have a very strong desire for some sort of order and form and some sort of pattern that they can follow that seems to be the right way to go. And they can be led. They can be led by cults. They can be led by groups of people. They can be led by, you know, intolerant governments and evil armies and corrupt politicians. They can be led. But I think as time rolls on, people are going to understand the need to have some sort of divine structure to things, some sort of belief in the sanctity of love and of truth. And a lot of that comes from religion. A lot of people's moral compass and the guidelines that they've used to follow to live a just and righteous life has come from religion. And unfortunately, a lot of very intelligent people, they dismiss all of the positive aspects of religion because they think that the stories are mere superstitious fairy tales, that, you know, they have no place in this modern world, and, you know, we're inherently good and your ethics are based on your old moral compass and we all have one, and that's not necessarily true. We need Jesus. I think for real. Like, if he came back now, it'd be great. Like, Jesus, if you're thinking about coming back.
Right now?
Now's a good time.
Yeah, pretty soon, yeah.
Now's a good time.
Well, there's a lot of people that think that might be coming.
Well, it might be.
If there is the Christianity part and Jesus wants to come back and save everything.
It'd be good right around now.
Yeah.
Like, don't wait till the election.
All right, so what do you make of that, Will?
I mean, it's pretty wild to hear.
I mean, you have Joe Rogan asking for Jesus to come back.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, a little facetious. I
don't think he wants that.
Joe, you don't want him to come back yet.
Yeah, there's a couple of things you need to take care of first. But one of the things that's interesting is he recognizes, we talked about this when we did the series on education, that one of the pillars of belief systems that always end up becoming extremely destructive is this view that mankind is just good. That there's not something, the sinful condition that draws them to himself. And he mentions that. He's like, you know, the world is going off on this belief that, you know, they have their own truth, that mm-hmm. man is basically good. And he's like, well, hey, maybe not. And the more we look at the world as it's being pulled away from absolutes, we see very clearly that it's getting worse and worse. And it's like everybody's on the same page, no matter what your political affiliation is or whatever. Your like wrong track beliefs of the world are off the charts right now. My brother often says that, oh, it's like a pendulum. You know, it swings from one extreme and it swings back to the other and then it swings back to the other side. And I was in a conversation with him and I said, you know, Mike, that's true typically.
Yeah.
But for a pendulum to work, it's hooked up to something that's above it, right? Yeah. And it swings back to it because it has something that it's hooked to that's calling it back to moderation. In our society, what I would argue is that the pendulum has snapped.
Yeah.
And that in our view of morality, there's nothing that what's the absolute that draws us back? Like, if there is no God, if there is no absolute, and it's just the opinion of the day and the whims of culture, and, you know, who God only knows what the next moral fad is. But I'll tell you, in the last 10 years, everybody's like, man, it can't get much worse. It can't get much worse. And it feels like every year or two, it's only accelerating. And without an agreed upon understanding that we need religion, even if you hate religion, you should recognize that society needs it. Because apart from it, the pendulums just keep swinging to the extremes, and there's nothing to call people back to a sense of love and mercy and decency and recognizing the dignity of the other side and recognizing that they're made in the image of God and to pulling people back to a moderate view.
And you think in our current culture, they believe it's an absolute truth. So there is a section to where now the majority is clinging to something that they'll die for, in a mm-hmm. sense. Like, there's not that, oh, this is just an opinion I hold. I can swing back, like your brother said, to the pendulum neutral, but there are no neutral values anymore. It's either we're running towards a flourishing world or we're running towards a world that's being destroyed by mm-hmm. beliefs.
But they're absolutely convinced
yeah.
that their view is going to bring flourishing. And the tragic thing is, you know, let's step back and go back to our like the Romans and the Greeks, you know. Okay, let's just look at culture and say, for the people who embrace faith in Christianity and they live as though the God of the Bible is true, you know, let's say they're deluded into believing all this stuff is true, their lives have radically better results, better rates of happiness, better rates of health. They become better citizens. They're less likely to engage in all the destructive behaviors. They yield forth life. They do the, and we're talking about generalities. Let's look at the studies. And on the other side, the people who grab hold of this new ethic, their lives are marked by the highest suicide rates the country's ever seen, and anxiety and crime that's rampant, and, you know, the dissolution of the nation, the division, the hatred. The people are just absolutely consumed with this idea that their life is all there is. There's nothing to come after it. And so it puts all the pressure on living for this moment in a world that can't offer them any satisfaction. It is the most desperate, hopeless, awful worldview. And we're thrusting it upon our kids, and they're collapsing under the weight of it. And nobody would say, oh, the younger generation, they're doing great. They're doing great. Let's keep it as it is. All right. So getting off the soapbox and getting back to the point of what this episode's going to be about. This is about the evolution of Richard Dawkins, having gone from 2006, where he is very anti-theist, and he says stuff about God like this. Brace yourself, because this is offensive.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
That hits your ears in a wild way. I mean, I don't know all of those words, first off, and that's obviously, he has a real hatred for him, because
yeah,
a paragraph like that does not just come off the top of your mind if you haven't sat on that for a while.
Yeah, so this was part of his book, you know, like early on. And this then, because back in those days, I got invited to go to different places to debate on like college campuses, Broward College, and to debate people that were coming from the atheistic framework. And this was always the argument. It wasn't just, hey, you know, Christianity, I've got some issues factually. It was a full frontal assault on the character of God that said that he was all these things, you know, and it was all victim language. So incidentally, by the way, all the woke language was in there. If you noticed, he's misogynist, he's a racist, he's genocidal, which is utterly absurd if you know the God of the Bible. Hmm. And, you know, if you want to pull those passages, like we could talk about those, and there are hard passages to work through. And man, the God of the Bible is beautiful. But this is the Richard Dawkins of 2006, 2007. And man, this went viral. So then the question became, you know, people were lining up to debate him, and some of the Christian apologists were looking to pin him down to say, okay, well, let's see what it would take to get you to become a Christian. And listen to his response as to what it would take.
But what would it take for you to believe in God?
Well, I used to say it would be very simple. It would be, you know, the second coming of Jesus, or a great big, deep, booming bass, Paul Robeson voice, saying, I am God and I created. But I was persuaded mostly by actually Steve Zara, who's a regular contributor to my website, richarddawkins.net. He more or less persuaded me that even if there was this booming voice and the second coming in clouds of glory, the more probable explanation is that it's a hallucination or a conjuring trick by David Copperfield or something. I mean, he made the point that a supernatural explanation for anything is incoherent, that it just doesn't sort of, it doesn't add up to an explanation for anything.
So what would persuade you?
Well, I'm starting to think nothing would, which in a way goes against the grain, because I've always paid lip service to the view that a scientist should change his mind when evidence is forthcoming. The trouble is, I can't think what that evidence would look like.
So here you have a scientist who's saying, there's no evidence imaginable that would ever lead me to say there is a God and I owe my life to him.
Which is wild for him to say out loud, and that. The interviewer pushed back a little bit, which I thought was interesting, but the crowd, I mean, talk about echo chamber. They were just having a great time.
So as we go through this episode and we listen to some different clips, you're going to pick up on the fact that the crowds laugh. They're so on board. This became the popular argument when you would get somebody and you would start talking about the evidence of the faith or the veracity of the Bible or the philosophical arguments, which are deadly to atheism. They would just go, well, it would be a delusion. Before I would ever believe in God, I would believe that I had lost my mind, because there's no possibility of there ever being a God. They were so closed-minded, and they pushed this. And it wasn't just Dawkins. There were other people. Of all the new atheists, they had essentially the same arguments. Here's another one. Peter Atkins answering essentially that same question.
You know, is there any kind of evidence in the universe that could make... I mean, if the stars lined up to spell, Peter, please believe in me, it's about time.
I put it down to madness.
You put it down... So,
personal madness.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, Peter, that there's no evidence that it would persuade you away from atheism.
Well, to be honest, I think that's probably the case.
In that sense, do you even have an evidence-based view if you're actually committed to atheism a priori?
Well, I'm predicting that there will be no such evidence. That's not quite the same thing as being committed to it a priori. I can't.
But you said there's no evidence that would persuade you otherwise.
I think it's much more likely that I would have gone mad than such evidence would have been provided.
I mean, talk about guys who are just so lost in pride. And speaking of egomaniacs, for them to say, I'm a scientist, but whatever happens, I'm just going to believe that I've gone mad.
Yeah, even if the stars spelled out a message, Peter, you know, come to me, give your life to me, I'm still not going to believe it. Like, that just shows that when you're trying to, and I mean, the Bible tells us this, by the way, the Bible tells us that unless the Spirit draws a person, they don't have eyes to see, they don't have ears to hear, they're not, you know, they're not, so in a sense, like, you're casting seed, but you're not going to win an argument that ultimately compels someone to give their life to Christ. That has to be the Spirit at work, and I'm hoping that the Spirit does work in the hearts of these guys. But it reminds me of the convert, like that when Jesus tells the story of Lazarus and the rich man is like, oh, if only somebody had told me, you know, and he's like, even if somebody rose from the dead,
yeah,
they wouldn't listen to him. And sure enough, they didn't. Like, so this idea that there's ever going to be enough evidence to draw somebody away from the throne where they think I'm in control of my life, I have autonomy, and the Bible says that they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. It's not the intellectual argument that's going to win someone to the faith, though that might encourage faith. Ultimately, it has to be you coming to the realization that your life does not belong to you. That God created you, God sustained you, God has a claim on your life, God is the designer of the universe, and you need to come into alignment with him, by the way, also recognizing that you have failed him. And he's made a path for you to come back to him through Christ, and they just mock it, mercilessly mock it.
Yeah, and these guys are like the intellectual Sauls before he became Paul.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, Paul, when he was Saul, but I'm going to use Paul, I mean, he was murdering Christians. He was doing everything to stop Christianity. I'm sure if you asked him, as you know, he was holding the coats as Stephen got stoned to death, he would almost make these same arguments, maybe not these intellectual ones, but he'd probably be like, no, unless nothing could change. But then all of a sudden, that Damascus Road moment, and bam, he's forever changed. And
that's right.
What these guys need, a movement of the Spirit.
Yeah, and to this day, by the way, just to give a spoiler alert, to date, Dawkins has not come to believe in God. He still holds that he believes that it's nonsense, but you're going to see a softening as we go through this episode of him over the years in recognizing what his own beliefs have wrought upon the world, which is not good, by the way. But the other side of Dawkins is you have a guy, you know, Oxford and microbiology and evolutionist and all these things, and he's a smart guy. Like, yeah. Nobody would ever accuse him of being a moron. You know, he might be foolish when it comes to the ultimate things of the world, but he's a smart man. He went on, you remember the, because I remember showing this when I was a WA teacher, probably shouldn't have, but I did. It was a movie called Expelled that Ben Stein did. Yeah. You remember that? Well, he had Dawkins on that program, and I remember watching the interaction between the two of them, in which Dawkins, who is so, it's like, under no circumstances will he yield any ground to the possibility that there might be a God. But listen to this clip and see what he is open to and tell me which is more absurd.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer. And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
Was that a low-key alien argument?
It wasn't even so low-key. Like, he's talking about an advanced civilization that's somewhere in our universe, seeding our planet with life. And then he's talking about, you know, so if we ever do find that there's some kind of a signature in the genetics of humanity, or if there's clear evidence of design, which, by the way, it's just so abundant now, well, it was probably some alien species from some far-flung place in the universe, which then, you know, of course, Ben Stein could have belabored the point, been like, okay, well, where did they come from? And what no atheist will cede is that everybody agrees that there has to be something eternal. It's either matter or it's God, right? But science shows that matter cannot be eternal. Right? Second law of thermodynamics. The fact that everything's, you know, expanding from a central origin. If you put it in reverse, it has an origin. Like, so that has to be abandoned. And now you're left with there being something eternal that's not material. Like a spirit, maybe, you know, that's outside of time and space and matter. Like, science makes you reason to a God, and yet he keeps chasing, well, could have been aliens. it could have been somewhere in the far-flung universe that they created all the laws of physics. It's like, okay, well, who created the laws for them? Who created the laws for them to, you know, transport all the seed of life to come to Earth? Like, this argument becomes so foolish, and yet it's spoken by somebody who's extremely smart academically, and yet even my 13 and 15 year old sons would listen to this and go, that's foolish, right? Professing to be wise, they became fools, the Bible says. And sometimes people get too smart for their own good to where they actually fall off the other side into just absolute utter nonsense.
Yeah, it's like when you have a babysitter when you're young and you break a lamp and then your parents come home and they start questioning about it. And it's like, well, the dog hit it. Well, then, why did the dog hit it? And they're like, well, we were throwing a baseball. And then, you know, you're always moving down the line. And they know you're just making stuff up by the fourth or fifth moment.
Yeah.
But you're just like, this is all I got. I got to hold on to it.
I remember coming when Laura, when Laura went on a women's retreat, I was walking through the kitchen and all of a sudden I see ink all over the walls.
Oh, gosh.
Handprints on the light fixture, like the switch, the toggle switch. It's just everywhere. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what's going on? And I walk out into the living room. Now, Leah is with Laura. She's a baby. I think Laura was still nursing at the time. And they're in Lake Placid. So they're not even in the county. And I look at Jacob, who has a beard of ink on his, whatever, five-year-old face. And I look at him and I said, Jacob, what in the world happened? And he looks at me with these big eyes and goes, Leah did it. It's like, dude, you have ink all over your face and your hands, and she's not here. Like, that's an utterly impossible argument. Just own it. And it's like, no matter how much you pin them down on the philosophic arguments, they will not yield. And it's fascinating to see. So where all of that then goes is, okay, let's say that you've won the momentum war. The church got caught sleeping. The new atheistic movement made huge strides into the youth. Well, what does that do? Because that doesn't just come with the argument that there is no God, because a lot of the criticism coming from Christian circles is, if you don't have a God, then you have no higher authority by which to claim objective morality. And so when these guys like Lawrence Krauss would go around putting on these things, they would get questions from college students saying, where do you get objective morality? And you would get answers like this.
Why is incest wrong?
It's not clear to me that it's wrong.
Okay.
It's clear to me. There's an evidence.
Listen to me. Listen to me. Wait. Let's give him the respect, please. He's got a justification.
You ask me a question, and if you want me to answer, I will.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. The point is, most societies have a taboo on incest, and it's an empirical one. Generally, incest produces genetic defects.
Yes.
Okay? And so in general, there's a physiological reason and a societal one why incest is wrong.
Yes.
Okay? But if you ask me the question, is it, and this is an interesting question, there's an ingrained incest taboo in almost all societies for that reason.
Sure.
Because societies want to persist, so it works. But if you ask me a priori, for example, the question, if a brother and a sister loved each other and used contraception, is there something absolutely morally wrong about that? And it was once, and they went off and it didn't affect anything else, I'd have to think about it, because I don't think there's any absolute condemnation of that fact. If they love each other and care for each other and they go off and it doesn't affect anything else,
okay.
Would I recommend it? No. Would I be particularly happy about it? But would I be willing to listen to those arguments? If they were rational, maybe.
I don't even know if you need commentary on that one, because he pretty much just shows his hand. That.
Where do you stand on the incest issue, Will?
I'm against it.
Like, okay, this is one of the things that the Bible in Leviticus comes ahead and says, like, okay, we don't do that. That's really wicked. But if you throw out God, like, I do appreciate the intellectual honesty of this guy who's speaking in front of a Christian audience, by the way, which is why there's the, oh, because, and if he was in front of the other side, you'll see in a minute, you don't get the, oh, you get cheers, as we're going to see in a minute. But this gets back to this idea. If you take away the ultimate authority and the only ethic that you can then come up with, which is what atheists will throw in your face all the time, you know, just don't do harm. Don't harm another person. Okay, well then, if it's consenting and there's no possibility of reproduction, then why is it bad? And you can see, by the way, this very ethic, this very argument, this very understanding of truth is what ultimately led to the acceptance of homosexuality and gay marriage, and now polygamy's coming around and all of these different things where it's like, well, who's it hurting? Well, if that's the standard, by the way, it's hurting them, just so you know, so we can be abundantly clear on this. Those behaviors are detrimental to the people who engage in them, for sure. And they begin to reduce the societal sacredness of those very things, the relationships, marriages, sexuality. Like, they are not victimless behaviors, no matter how much they want to paint them this way. And so this seems like an extreme one, right? Like a guy defending incest. Wow. This was not at all out of the norm for the new atheist. So that's very similar question talking about incest is posed to two of the loudest leaders of the new atheist movement, Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris. Here's how they respond.
I had to write an essay on something which society considers taboo or disgusting. Anything I wanted to kind of write about, and I had to try and justify it. And what I was kind of came up with is the topic of incest. Society thinks it's disgusting, it's weird, it's odd. So this is my question, really, and I talked about this in my essay. Two sisters, they can't produce children which are disabled, they're in love, and they're not harming anyone. So my question is, apart from saying it's disgusting, weird, and therefore wrong, can you give one good reason as to why two people are in love and not harming people shouldn't be together? Just one good reason that's not, it's disgusting, just like people said against homosexuals.
Okay. Yeah, it's a very clever device to make it two sisters. I think that's brilliant. And I think that this beautifully points up the difference between absolutist morality, where you just say it's disgusting, the yuck factor, and utilitarian or consequentialist morality. I think you're absolutely right. I can see no reason at all why that these two sisters shouldn't marry if they want to.
So, it's another great clip.
I suppose if no, I think that stands. Yeah.
That's going to be great on YouTube, Richard.
We could make it better by just agreeing with him.
Well, one other consequentialist
this is Sam
point
Harris.
I would make is that in the local case, it might well be not wrong for two people who can't have kids and can't suffer in any way to be, you know, prosecuting their taboo love for one another. But there's, I think, part of the consequences are the just what happens to society, what happens to other relationships, what happens. I mean, you're in dialogue. You're not in a moral solitude usually with your behavior.
All right, so you have Dawkins who comes along and says, yeah, go for it. I see nothing wrong with it. Again, I appreciate the intellectual honesty that if there is no God, of course there's nothing wrong with it. But then you have Sam Harris who comes along and he wants to throw in this extra little bit where he says, okay, but yeah, there's nothing wrong for two sisters to have a relationship. You know, go for it, have at it. You're not harming anyone. But then he wants to say, you know, okay, according to the consequentialist view of ethics, if this did go beyond that and harm somebody else, then we have this kind of social contract where we're agreeing as human beings living together that we don't want to engage in any behavior that harms another person, which is the dominant ethic in atheism. What's wrong with that view of ethics? Beyond the fact that, one, you owe everything to God, but let's just take the philosophical perspective. Like, what's wrong? Why does that not work in the real world to say, if a behavior harms someone else, we should all agree not to do it?
If I get to decide what harms me or not.
One, okay, you get to decide what harms you. Look at our world right now where we're thinking half of the country or whatever percentage thinks, you know what, it's a good thing for 11-year-olds to be able to permanently alter themselves and mutilate their genitals and undergo irreparable harm to themselves. Mm-hmm. We can't agree on that for the love of Pete. So, okay, now we're agreeing that we can't agree on what harms each other. So that's one. But beyond that, you have, okay, basically the argument goes like this. Out of self-interest for myself, I won't harm you because I don't want what?
You to harm me.
I don't want you to harm me, which works if everybody's on a level playing field and everybody's vulnerable to each other. But if you say, Kim Jong-il, how about this? I'm going to be nice to you if you're nice to me.
He doesn't care.
He doesn't. Why not?
Because he has all the power. He can do whatever he wants to.
That's absolutely right. If I've got all the power, I don't care. I don't need this social contract. I can have you knocked off. There's your word again.
How does that keep coming?
I don't know, but it that time I did it on purpose, but it was in the moment. But anyway, like you can, I'm not vulnerable. I don't need your dumb social contract. Go away from me. I'll do whatever I want. I'll live however I want. And so when you take God as the absolute authority out of the picture, you get a society that tramples one another, where the powerful absolutely always trample over the weak. And that's why whenever you come across harsh dictatorships, what's goal number one of a dictator? Get rid of religion. Because religion tells people that you have an obligation to a being higher than the state. And that is what gives people liberty. That's what gives people dignity. That's what gives people the courage to say no. And when you lose that, you fall to tyranny and corruption and abuse so quickly. And by the way, we're beginning to see that in Western cultures today. So Sam Harris's argument just does not hold water. And so now we get into this really fascinating development where you have them pushing for the death of Christianity, right? Pushing for the church to wither, for the church to withdraw. And then they start succeeding. You see the abandonment of Christian ethics in our culture, but they get surprised that it's not replaced with this, you know, wonderful enlightenment where everybody is just enjoying life to the full now that religion is waning.
Due to reason, yeah.
Yeah. Now the world becomes absolutely idiotic. And all, by the way, all of the new atheists hate where the world is going. They all hate the wokeism because they see all of the traits of really oppressive religiosity that's taken root in wokeism. So Dawkins and Harris and Bill Maher and all these guys that have been so hostile toward Christianity are now looking at what's replacing Christianity, and they're going, whoa, this is not good for us. This is not good for society. And listen to the first time that Dawkins realizes what he's done.
As religiosity decreased, deranged woke beliefs increased. Do you think that as one religion fades, another, like default is the belief state for humans? They just have to believe something. And as one, as the old religion fades, a new one has to come in?
Yeah. Gullibility expands to fill the vacuum.
Exactly.
Or something. Yeah.
Precisely.
I suppose that's right. I hadn't really thought of it before, but it sounds plausible to me. I think G.K. Chesterton, who was a very religious man, said when people stop believing in God, they believe in anything.
So there you have Dawkins stumbling on the reality that he was a lot happier when Christianity was the dominant worldview in society. And now they're looking at, you know, the emergence of woke. And what is wokeism? Because it's oppressive, it's cruel, it will come after you if you stand against any of its tenets. It is totally anti-science. It's not rational. It doesn't look at empirical things. It's all about feelings, but it is like so violently vehement and zealous in what it holds that he sees this is dangerous, not just for Christians, not just for society, but for open-minded thinkers. And so this is the first time where he's like, oh my gosh, like, I think you're right. We've made a void of young Christians coming in, and it's been replaced because, by the way, you always have a dominant worldview. Whether you realize it or not, you worship something. But now we've removed Christianity, and this wokeism, this cult of wokeism has filled the void. And this is where Jordan Peterson, who is a psychologist, Canadian psychologist, conservative thinker, actually went to Dawkins and he says, okay, you've devoted your life to standing against religion. Now that you're seeing all the dangers of wokeism coming, are you willing to call wokeism a religion? And here's Dawkins' response.
I'm happy to do so because I greatly respect Dr. Peterson's courageous stance against a bossy, intolerant thought police whose Orwellian newspeak threatens enlightened rationalism. Here is the first of Dr. Peterson's challenges to me. Does woke count as a religion, sir? A serious question. My answer to the question is no if you include supernaturalism in your definition of a religion, but the following three similarities are enough for me to justify a yes answer to Jordan's question. The first of the three is characteristic of religions in general. The other two are kin to Christianity in particular. Heresy hunting. Ruthlessly uncompromising, relentlessly unforgiving persecution of heretics. There is an orthodoxy, not written down in one particular scripture, but understood by all votaries. And woe betide you if you transgress. As a minimum, you'll find yourself in the Twitter stocks, pelted with abusive epithets as a bigot. And you may well find yourself out of a job, as universities, governments, and businesses queue up to signal their virtue. Such latter-day talkamardism rams home the fact that what we have here is a cult, with its own religiously enforced dogma. Dogma that makes no sense to anyone outside, but which resonates perfectly with cult insiders and their sheep-like followers. Why is a white woman in America vilified and damned if she identifies as black, but lauded if she identifies as a man? That's topsy-turvy, because race really is a continuum, whereas sex is one of the few genuine binaries of biology. Why do journalists, police, and prison authorities respectfully kowtow to a convicted rapist by referring to her as she? Why do so many of us go along with a distortion of language so perverse that it comes perilously close to 2 + 2 = 5? We know the answer, cowardice. Too many of us are afraid of the baying mob.
I never thought I would say amen to Richard Dawkins. But yes, like, yes, this is it. And this gets to the point, like, Richard Dawkins may not bow the knee to my king, right?
Yeah.
But he is an enemy to the greatest ideological enemy that I see threatening our society right now. I think the atheism has passed. I think people don't, they see the flaws in it. They see that it's foolish ultimately. And now we're left with this woke cult that now he sees, oh my gosh, this is endangering Western civilization. And so he may not bow the knee to Jesus yet, but he sees the danger of this. And so I want to commend him. Yes, this is a very real and present danger to Western civilization. And it's interesting that he comes to that. And they absolutely are a group of heresy hunters. They will cancel you. They will hunt you if you disagree with the slightest bit of their orthodoxy. If you affirm 99% of their orthodoxy, but you stand against them on one, you're anathema to them. And they will come and hunt you down, like J.K. Rowling or Martina Navratilova or any of the myriad of people who takes a stance against them on any point. And they are canceled. It is such an oppressive, disgusting, anti-liberty, I'll say satanic worldview that anytime I can get an ally to speak against it, I'll take them.
Yeah, and that should make us think if Richard Dawkins is on the same side as Christianity, that should like cue you in. Like, this is a deal of all deals.
Yeah, strange bedfellows right there.
He's not known for that.
Yeah, no, he's certainly not. So that was he makes 3 points. He says, first off, the sign that they're a religion is that they are a group of heresy hunters who will destroy you if you stand against their orthodoxy. So here comes point number two.
Hereditary guilt. Today's original sins are slavery and colonial oppression. All white people are born in sin, the sin of their ancestors. From the moment they are born, all white people partake in the institutional racism handed down like Adam Seaman from their great-great-great-grandfathers, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon their children unto the third and fourth generation.
Again, I'll say amen to that. Like the way that wokeism comes and says, you know, that there are innate characteristics about who you are, like your skin color or your gender. They come along and they say that you're guilty based on things that have nothing to do with your behavior or your beliefs. You're guilty by nature of who you are. And it just breeds this resentment, this like, oh, you're white. Well, then you're part of the wicked. You're part of the people that you don't need to grovel. And the thing about this that stands so hostile to the gospel is there's no atonement for that. You never get to leave that shame behind. You can never do enough to wash away the whiteness. You can never do enough to wash away the maleness. Like everything about that becomes just this oppressive cycle of inescapable guilt and shame. And it just tears at the fabric of society.
It's helpful for guys like Dawkins to say these kinds of things, to be honest.
Yeah. Right? Because here goes those Christians again. Like, no, people with rational minds that observe the way that this is going in our culture are saying, like, this is not good. And they treat it like the original sin. Like, you know, for Adam, it's all of humanity is born with this sinful condition, which, by the way, binds all races together. Like, we all suffer greed. We all suffer selfishness. We all have to struggle against death and depression. And that forges us together. What wokeism does is it starts slicing and dicing humanity to say, no, 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 those are the oppressors. These are the victims. It tears apart. It's the same Marxist playbook that goes back into the early days of Marxism that pits victimhood against other people for the sake of violence and power. It goes back to the days of Cain and Abel, where Cain says, I should have that. Abel's to blame. Let me blot him out. And one of the oldest stories in the Bible is about envy. And I deserve that. I'm going to take it. That's what this cult of woke does, except it does it by racial lines and gender lines and sexuality lines and wealth lines. And you draw something that has distinctives and they will find a way to bring divisiveness out of that point. It's gross. And I think Dawkins is spot on here. So then we get to his third point.
Transubstantiation. Roman Catholics are required to believe that bread and wine, when a priest says certain magic words over them, become the body and blood of Christ, in a stronger sense than Protestants, who see the bread and wine as mere symbols. Similarly, in the cult of woke, a man speaks the magic incantation, I am a woman. and thereby becomes a woman in true substance, while her intact penis and hairy chest are mere Aristotelian accidentals. Transsexuals have transubstantiated genitals. One thing to be said in favor of today's Catholics, at least they don't nowadays insist that everybody else must go along with their beliefs.
I mean, that's a wild clip, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, basing off the Roman Catholics, it'd say, I said these words, and now the bread that you see and the wine that you see is now, even though nothing's changed, the body and blood of Jesus in real form. Was a crazy thought to go to transgenderism, but it works that, like, just because I say I am what I am doesn't change the physical nature of who I am.
But the Catholic view is infinitely more logical. Like, if you believe in a supernatural God, is it possible
that he could do that?
That he could do that? Absolutely. But we're the cult of woke, which I like that expression, so I'm going to take it. The cult of woke says, no, it's just my opinion and my desire, and so I speak I am a woman, and then it just magically happens with no supernatural aid, just the mere opinion of the person. Like, how delusional as a society have we gotten? And so this is where Dawkins, and those are the three points that he throws out there. And I think they're effective points, but this is where he's starting to recognize that into the void of traditional Christianity has come this wokeism that is so much more toxic, except where Christianity holds to its traditions and it holds to the values that it affirms, wokeism genuinely comes along and it's suicidal in all of its ways. It says, I hate who we are. I hate our culture. Our whole history is oppressive. And by the way, all the things that we affirm are going to be things that are barren or destructive to life. We're gonna lift up sexuality that can't reproduce. We're going to say that humanity should not reproduce for the sake of the planet. We're going to affirm abortion rights. And everything that they start promoting is hostile to the idea of what God's commandments accomplish, which are life and beauty and flourishing. The wokeism says we're not worthy of life. It's such a defeatist, terrible, awful view of you, your heritage, your family, everything about you. And it just causes the West and everything it stands for and all the wonderful traditions that we have inherited and could build upon and make better. It rejects them and throws them in the dumpster. And Jordan Peterson, who started this conversation, lays this squarely at the feet of men like Richard Dawkins. And so in a really beautiful and profound message to Dawkins, Jordan Peterson writes this. He says, "Welcome to the world of post-humanism, sir." Now that's weird because it's not just post-Christian. Now it's post-human. So now humanity is bad. Like, humanity's existence itself is bad. We're ashamed of what we've done. We're ashamed of who we are. We deserve to go away. That's kind of the dominant ethic. And he is laying that charge down at Dawkins. And he continues and he says, "A world which you sadly helped birth, and nothing secular will withstand it." It's true. Like, nothing secular causes people to say, "I'll give my life for this." Secularism that holds that there's nothing beyond this world, so I need to protect my life and just get whatever I can, the little petty trinkets of pleasure, out of this life. It will never lead someone to say, "I'll give my life for this." So nothing secular can withstand it, as you can no doubt see. I say this with genuine sorrow, not least because I know that you're a real scientist with the faith in the logos of the cosmos that entails. Yet here we are. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the woke, polytheistic, neo-paganists destroy science faster than they destroy Christianity. And so in response to that, Richard Dawkins says this.
Peterson is right to imply in the rhetorical tone of his question that there is a religion of woke. I've mentioned two specific similarities to Christianity, but more important is their extreme intolerant zeal shared with typical new cults. Peterson's tone is more civilized, of course, but the message is the same. We who have spoken out against the irrationality of religion are to blame for the rise of the irrationality of woke. There is a certain logic that might be said to underlie the indictment. I get the point, but I love truth too much to go along with it. I, along with Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, Victor Stenger, Lawrence Krauss, Michael Shermer, and others, are against all religions without exception. And that includes the cult of woke.
And so now Dawkins is looking at a future of Europe, where he is, that looks like it's a choice between this irrational, intolerant wokeism and radical, intolerant Islam, which is increasing tremendously. And he's recognizing that wokeism has absolutely no backbone to stand for this fight, and neither does the new atheism. And so now he's looking at a future that looks increasingly like Europe will fall to Islam. And this is what he has to say about that.
Insofar as Christianity can be seen as a bulwark against Islam, I think it's a very good thing. I mean, in Africa, for example, where you have missionaries of both faiths operating, I'm on team Christian side as far as that's concerned.
It's interesting because I sort of thought that you would be more of a Hitchenite, God is not great advocate. But it's interesting to me that you see the value and the force for good of the United Kingdom having a Christian foundation.
Yes, but I must emphasize that I think that the things that Christians believe are actually nonsense.
Did you ever think that you would hear Richard Dawkins say that he's on team Christian?
Not with those words.
But he's coming to the point where he realizes that his worldview has a desperately fatal flaw. It cannot stand against these evils like Islam and wokeism. It has no thrust behind it, no ultimate meaning, no purpose, no gravity to life, nothing by which you would say, this is worth me dedicating my life to standing against this evil. And so it just watches as Europe gets rolled into darkness because the church has fallen asleep. And if nothing else, like, I hear you have Dawkins who's saying, come on, Christian missionaries, like, we need your help to stand against the onslaught of these worldviews that are terrible. And so that leads us into the clip that sparked our interest in doing this particular podcast to start with. And that was from a show that Richard Dawkins did over the weekend on Easter Sunday. And the show host was asking him what he thinks about the fact that now you have Britain that is celebrating Ramadan publicly rather than Easter. And, you know, over here we have all of the stuff with Transgender Visibility Day and everything else. Like, so you see the sacredness of the Easter holiday fading in both Europe and in America, and Islam being heralded over there and wokeism being heralded over here. This is his response.
Professor Dawkins, it's very good to have you join us to discuss whether it matters that Christianity is playing a diminishing role in national life. Welcome to LBC.
Thank you.
And what would be your Easter message? I've said a few things. What would you tell the nation?
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense.
All right, so there's just a lot of wild things going on in that clip. I mean, you have Richard Dawkins. If you just remember the earlier clip where he has all those things to say about the God of the Bible, and now you have him saying, you know, I feel rather at home in a Christian-influenced country, right? And then he's, you know, referring to himself as a cultural Christian, which, by the way, there's no such thing. You can't get the kingdom without the king. But that's exactly what he's after. You know, we've done episodes before where, you know, people in the Bible are always chasing after the Garden of Eden, but they don't want God there. And you can't have that, because if you reject the king, the kingdom goes with him. It will dissipate. It will disappear from your hands. The ethics don't come unless you embrace him. But here you have, it's just fascinating to me that Richard Dawkins is saying, no. This is a country that is founded on Christian ideals, and that's worth fighting for, and I rather like it. This is, by you know, the news media standards in America, you'd call him a Christian nationalist, you know, like, I want a Christian country. But why is it that he wants this?
Because he's afraid of what happens if it's not.
Because he sees the writing on the wall. That's right. He sees the writing on the wall that the two other trajectories of the West are Islam and the woke cult, and they're both terrifying.
And I think Islam beats the woke cult in the end.
Yeah. Both of them are radically intolerant and terrifying, and they do not put up with their enemies. And it's the vestiges of Christianity that has kept the neo-Marxist woke cult from becoming violent. Because remember, it was after the revolution gained total control and power. Every time that happens in Marxist countries, what happens? What follows? Bloodbaths. Mm. Millions dead, right? And so, like, we try to pacify ourselves by being like, oh no, they'll be different this time. You know, they really don't hate us that much. And it's like, dude, have you seen the rage and the total animosity that is hidden behind this? Like, Christians need to wake up and realize that we have a fight on our hands for the future of our Western society, not just our country, but Western society. And it is worth saluting the king and kneeling to the king and recognizing that his design is so supreme over all of the other options that are in front of us. In fact, the other options that are in front of us, even the atheists are saying, are terrifying.
Yeah.
We need to stand. We need to stand for truth. We need to reclaim those things. Because if we don't, the future's bleak. It is worth getting zealous. I'll say it. Zealous for your faith.
Yeah, and this episode comes on the heels of the Ten Commandments, which is the purpose of this.
That's right.
That there's a God and he says, hey, this is what a flourishing life looks like. You can avoid it all you want. You can act like it's not there. You can choose to close your eyes. But even a guy like Richard Dawkins says, hey, those rules, they make for a much better world than anything else I can think of.
And the reality is, it's like I said a moment ago, you cannot be a cultural Christian. Like, to become a Christian means that you recognize that you don't have it figured out, that you don't have it morally figured out, that you have fallen short of the standards of the king, that all this beautiful design and all the laws and everything else that God has put in front of you, that you cannot do that on your own. And so out of humility, it calls you not to say, I'm a Christian and therefore I'm better than everyone else. That's the farthest thing from it. It's when you recognize that you're a Christian, it's a statement of humility that I can't do this on my own, that I was lost, that I was the enemy, that I had all of these dysfunctions and death and destruction, the seeds of all that stuff in me, and I had to be rescued. And so while you stand for truth, you stand on a foundation that you had nothing to do with building. It is entirely the goodness of God that has come and given us this foundation, and it is our responsibilities as stewards of that truth and stewards of that gospel and recipients of that mercy and that grace that we have to be defenders of that truth, and we have to offer that hope. And the church has failed to do that on both counts, defending the truth and being merciful and gracious. And we need to get serious about kingdom business right now.
Amen.
And so Dawkins, I'll let you listen to the last bit of this interview that has to do with him addressing what he fears if Christianity doesn't come back and Islam moves forward.
It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we... Certainly, if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Well, which brings me to my supplementary point, which is that, as we know, church attendance is plummeting, but the erection of mosques across Europe, I think 6,000 are under construction, and there are many more, I mean, are being planned. So do you regard that as a problem? Do you think that matters?
Yes, I do, really. I mean, I have to choose my words carefully. I mean, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time. I mean, it seems to me to be a fundamentally decent religion in a way that I think Islam is not. And I find that I like to live in a culturally Christian country, although I do not believe a single word of the Christian faith.
Again, not to belabor the point, but here you have the leading atheistic evangelist of our time grieving the fact that Christianity is in retreat. He wants the cathedrals and the churches, and he wants them empty, and he wants all the laws and designs of God that Christians have heralded for millennia, but he doesn't want them to worship that God. Mm. He still hates God, but he grieves the loss of God's designs. And church, like when the atheists are starting to come and to offer prophetic firepower for Christians, saying, we're not going in a good direction. If we lose, if the gospel retreats, if Christianity fades, the future is bleak for the coming generations. If that's not a wake-up call for the church to begin taking the gospel and the word of God seriously, I don't know what is. It's time for us to wake up. Amen, Will?
Amen.
All right, so this has been a look into the evolution of Richard Dawkins over the last 18 years since he first published The God Delusion. And out of the gates, you hear this again, to summarize, this guy that's just vehemently and vitriolic against God, and he wants to tear down Christianity, and he is absolutely merciless in wanting to tear it down. And now that he has seen that Christianity in Europe is on the retreat, and he sees the consequences of what that has accomplished, it is a terrifying prospect for him, because Islam and the cult of woke, they are not worthy successors to the throne of ethics in our world. And the good news is every time that we have seen cultural movements like this where the world seemed like it was right on the edge of a cliff, it inevitably sparks revival where the young people look at a world that they're about to inherit and they begin crying out for truth. They want something better than what the world has to offer because they instinctively recognize that it is utter nonsense. Church, give them truth. And so that is going to end our time. I hope this has been enlightening, enjoyable, edifying, and above all, like, I hope that this really helps to build a resolve in each and every one of us that we've got a better message for the world. We have a better hope for the world. And you know what? It's time to start offering it. It's been fun, Will. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.